Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, I talk to well-known librarian, blogger, podcaster, and author Betsy Bird. You may know Betsy as Fuse 8, but without the help of the internet, you would never guess what Fuse 8 means, unless you were a mechanic. Among other topics, Betsy and I talk about the origin of Fuse 8, how she came to be a librarian, what to do with, quote, problematic books, and the mischievous acts of favorite children's book creators. We also ponder the possibility that we live in an alternate timeline because of our collective false memory of the Berenstain Bears. I hope you enjoy our conversation. We have a lot to cover, and not a whole lot of time. We got a hard 45, so let's try and get it all in, shall we?
All right, we're gonna do it.
All right. I have this weird nervous energy, as if I'm talking to a librarian. Like, I feel like I'm asking a librarian a question for which I should know the answer, and I'm about to be reprimanded for not knowing the answer. That's the energy I'm feeling right now.
You're feeling librarian shame.
I have a feeling you're not that kind of librarian. Let's find out what kind of librarian you are.
Excellent. Let's do it.
You grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And yes, Kalamazoo is a real place. It is one of many exotic locales that including and neatly rhyming with Timbuktu.
Nearly.
Yeah, nearly. So what was a young Betsy Bird doing? How were you spending your time growing up in Kalamazoo?
I was a shy little beast. Did not speak up much in class. Didn't have that many close friends. Spent a lot of time outdoors. Spent a lot of time on my own. Read, sure, but I wouldn't have called myself an extreme reader by any stretch of the imagination. I cannot conjure up a single librarian that I knew during this time period. Mm-hmm. So it's all the stranger. That's the profession that I went into.
Right.
But yeah, Betsy, young Betsy Ramsey, because that was my name at the time. Kind of a loner, liked theater, nerd, not very much a nerd, but the kind of kid who would spend all the recess walking the perimeter of the playground because there was literally nothing else I thought I could do.
Right.
That's the saddest portrait I've ever painted of myself. Like, I need a little violin to play at the same time.
Yeah. I'll throw that in there in post. Being a librarian wasn't one of those like, well, I always wanted to be one. I mean, what did you?
Oh no.
What were some of the occupations that you were wanting to get into?
Well, writer first and foremost. My aunt was a writer. She had published books and everything. She was writing YA before there was YA. That whole nine yards. And so writer. But then at a certain point, I was like, well, that's not a job. You know, pay the bills by being a writer. This is what I thought at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that is an impractical situation. And I was very clear that the minute I got out of college, I was on my own. This was not anything my parents had told me. It was just something I internally believed. I was like, no, you get out of college and you're alone in the universe and you must do something. So I didn't want to be a librarian. I fought tooth and nail against it, but I was doomed to the profession. I thought I wanted to be a photographer. That's a sexy profession, you know. Mm-hmm. Take photos. And I did a bunch of different types of photography before I learned that I'm not a great photographer. I'm okay. I'm not great. I still don't really know what an f-stop is to this day. So, but meanwhile, here I am like alphabetizing all my family's books in the entire house, making subject heading charts for my National Geographic magazines for fun. You know, this was what I was doing.
Okay.
Until finally I just sort of, I hedged my bets. I was an English major, but I was also a fine arts major with a concentration in photography. But I had that English degree that I could fall back on. Mm-hmm. And fall back I did. Oh, the falling.
How did you become a librarian? I mean, what was that decision process like?
So at a certain point, I just realized, okay, I want to be a librarian. But I was in Portland, Oregon. And at the time, online library school, not really an option. Mm. So I moved to Minneapolis, where there was a library school in St. Paul. And even then, I was like, well, I'm going to be an archival librarian. I'm going to conserve books. I'm going to preserve books. And I came home one day and my husband was like, you've just put your coffee cup on the book on how to preserve books. And I'm like, it's a sign. Okay, yeah. Maybe this is not for me. And I took a children's literature course on a lark just to fulfill a credit. And it was like a little lightning bolt from the sky hit me. I had been reading children's books on my own for fun for years. I was into Harry Potter before of all you people back in 1999. And I was in England reading the second one. And I loved it. And then after that, I read His Dark Materials. And then I was reading Holes and all that stuff. So when I took the course, I was like, oh, I really like this.
What was your first job as a librarian?
Oh, well, that was one of those weird situations. I moved to New York because my husband got into Columbia's film school program. And in Minnesota, people grab onto their jobs and they don't move until they die. And so I wasn't able to get a job there. But I went to New York and they were hiring. They were hiring like crazy. This was in 2003. And I got a job at the Jefferson Market branch, the best of all the branches.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the Village, right?
Yeah, that's what I did. Yeah, that's in the Village. It's a castle. I essentially was given a castle.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And what was your responsibility
there? That worked out great. Oh, I was the children's librarian. It wasn't supposed to be. This is a sad story, actually. Usually what would happen is you would work for 6 months with an established children's librarian, and then after that, you would have to find your own branch. My librarian promptly died, and I inherited the branch. And let me tell you, people who'd been waiting to try their hand at that branch for years were not pleased that this doofus from Minnesota just sort of waltzed in and was like, hello, and oh, I guess this is my branch now. Mm-hmm. You know, the most beautiful library, one of the most beautiful children's rooms in all of New York City. And it fell in the lap of somebody who was fresh out of grad school. But that is a pretty good encapsulation of my life, like right there. Right. So, yep.
At what point did your grandmother say to you, you need to take my beat up old Buick because I'm tired of seeing it in the parking lot of my retirement home?
Oh, look at you doing your research, knowing all my stories. Yeah, this was my senior year of college. I hadn't had a car ever. And my grandma owned this 1989 Buick Century. You know, the kind of, she couldn't drive. It'd been sitting out in the parking lot of the retirement home for years. The paint was peeling off the roof. It was not an attractive vehicle. I loved that car so much. My first set of wheels, ugliest set of wheels. Literally got it because it was ugly, mm-hmm. and I didn't care. It was mm-hmm. my car. I drove it. I loved it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Though it did have some flaws.
It did. So I didn't know that there is a fuse in a glove compartment. Maybe I should know that as a car owner.
But, you and me both.
Yeah. So your car...
I don't know that there are any.
It had a little bit of a problem with one of the fuses. The eighth fuse, to be specific.
This is true.
So what exactly happened?
Well, this was, you know, I graduate from college. I'm staying in Richmond, Indiana for the summer before I trek off to become some fancy photographer. And I park my car, take the key out of the car, and all the electric locks go up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And I'm like, oh my gosh, my car is possessed.
Yeah.
That is literally the only explanation that there can be. So I leave it because there was nothing valuable inside. And then I come back later and the battery's dead, because if you've got a car whose blocks are going up and down all night, you know, so I, you know, charge the battery, take it in. I have no money. I just graduated from college. I got nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm going to have to put this on the credit card. I'm never going to be able to pay this off. What is this? And the guy looks at me, could tell, like, this person has no money, reaches into the glove compartment and pulls out fuse number 8 and says, take this out. Your locks will be fine. Just put it back in when you're driving.
Yeah.
If you have it out, it controls the horn, the windshield wipers, the radio. So that's what I do. I just plug it in when I drove, and then whenever I parked anywhere, pull it out. If I forgot, I regretted it. That just seemed like a very workable solution to me. I was like, of course. And that car took me to Portland, Oregon. It took me to Minneapolis, Minnesota. It drove me everywhere. That car had good mileage on it.
For years, I was like, there's got to be something children's book related to this that I'm just missing. It's obvious. I'm sure it's like right in front of my nose. Fuse 8, maybe it's part of it, maybe it's a line in a book. I just don't know. And so I'm glad that I now know, because it's...
Well, you yourself spoke with Leonard Marcus. He was at a party with Leonard, and he says to me, why is it called Fuse 8? I tell him the whole story, Linda Blair, all that stuff. And he's like, so it has nothing to do with children's books. Yeah. And I'm like, no, it was supposed to be the name of my husband's production company. And by I say suppose so, it was my suggestion. He was looking for the name of a production company. Mm-hmm. He wanted to call it Widow Be Damned Productions because he was having some difficulty getting some rights. I wanted to call it a Fuse Number 8 production. He said he wouldn't do it. And I was like, well, by gum, someday I'll name something that.
Yeah.
And it sticks in the brain. It's a sticky little name.
I first learned about Fuse Number 8 back in 2004. So you were in New York for a few years now, and I was at Simon & Schuster as an associate art director. And about 2004, 2005, there was a blog post that you had written. I will not discuss the details of it.
I know exactly probably what it was.
I learned about it. I was aware. I was made aware of your presence. And
yes.
Yeah. So then I'm like, okay, so now I know who Betsy Bird is. Years go by, and now it's 2011, and I am a brand new art director at Penguin. Your name came up again because you had made a comment about... So one of the many imprints for which I was... I oversaw, in addition to Frederick Warren and Price Stern Sloan and others, was Grossen and Dunlap. Mm-hmm. And you had made a comment during a librarian preview, something to the effect of, like, because, you know, there's a scheduling, and sometimes your imprint is first, sometimes it's last. And you had made a comment, something along the lines of, you know, who decided to put Grossen and Dunlap first, or something like that. And it pissed some people off.
As well it should.
And so then, you know, skip a couple days, and then we start talking about the fact that you focused more of your very, you know, your attention, which was considerable. You know, you have a lot of followers and a lot of people listen to what you do. And we're going to talk about what you do in a sec, and what you think and what you say about our books. And so you focused a bit too much from our perspective on the handlebar mustache of one of our editors, and not on the books that we were publishing.
In my defense, it was a magnificent mustache.
It certainly was. Definitely was. So anyway, so in response, I was the person in charge of this. We sent you a 6-foot-long, 3-foot-high, black foam core handlebar mustache.
You did.
And every one of us signed it.
You did. It was the greatest gift of my entire life. If insulting people and ignoring them leads to mustaches that big, I have not learned my lesson well. I get this, and I'm about to move, because we were in the main branch of Near Public Library, and we were about to be moved to Book Ops in Long Island City, right? I get this enormous package. It's huge. I open it up. I can't believe what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. It is like you were reading my dream journal. The biggest mustache of all time. It was displayed proudly in my cubicle. And then when we moved to Long Island City, it was there until the day I left. And I had to leave it behind when I moved to Evanston, Illinois. And I am sad about that to this day, that I had to leave behind my beautiful, beautiful mustache. It was so well cut out. It was even on both sides. Mm-hmm. You had to make two pieces and then like tape it together because it was just too big.
Yeah.
You had to custom cut the cardboard boxes around it just to get it in the mail. It was glorious.
Yeah. And I was like, I was an art director at Simon & Schuster right before then. And this is, again, just 2 weeks into my new job here. And hours were spent.
Oh, no. The craftsmanship was remarkable.
And I
admired that thing so much. Yeah.
I'm happy to hear that. I was thinking, though, like, is this part of my job? I mean, is this what we do? Are we sending mustaches to librarians now? Okay, cool.
Just one librarian.
Yeah. So right before you left New York, what was your title for the New York Public Library?
I was the youth materials specialist of New York Public Library, which meant I bought all the children's books for Manhattan, Staten Island, and the Bronx. And for a month for Brooklyn. It was so sweet. I had 4 out of 5 boroughs. Never got Queens.
The librarian previews you know, I guess every publisher has a librarian preview in which the publishers, the editors are like pitching to librarians, you included, the next season of books. Mm-hmm. Is that how you, I mean, you purchased, I read somewhere that you'd spent seven figures. Your responsibility was spending seven figures.
I had $1 million budget, $1 million annual budget
on
to buy
what?
Books. Yeah.
And
for 96 branches.
You and who else?
Oh, no, it was just me. I mean, I just did the children's. Other people did. So it was me for children's. Then we had some people who did the adult. They had more people to do the adult.
Okay.
And then we had someone to do the YA. And we had someone to do the children's for Brooklyn and someone to do the children's for – or the YA for Brooklyn and the adult selectors. But, no, I was the only game in town when it came to children's stuff. Yeah.
Exactly why we were like, why is she talking about mustaches and not our books?
But
that's in the past.
Yeah, I still bought them.
Right. Okay, so the librarian previews then, is that the primary way in which you find out about the books and then decide to purchase them or not? Or are there other ways?
Not at all. It's, as far as I can tell, it's lovely. It's very nice. I could not figure out when I first started getting invited to these why these weren't better known around the country. I'm like, so let me get this straight. You get a select group of librarians from the New York area.
Yeah.
You do this huge presentation for them. In mm-hmm. some cases, you know, Little Brown had us at the Yale Club fetting us with like waiters and tiny sandwiches with apple and ham in them.
Right.
You know, you do all this whole thing. You have special guests come in, like authors come in and sign books. And it goes where? It's just the New York people who are mm-hmm. buying them. And in the old days, that made sense when it was the days of Ann Carroll Moore, because where she bought, so bought the whole nation. But these days, any librarian who wants to buy children's books usually do what I do. You get your Baker and Taylor carts. The carts have the reviews already attached to each book. You read the review. You decide if you're going to buy the book. You go almost entirely by reviews. So when I started typing up these previews to put on my blog so that other people around the country could actually know about these books, it just seemed odd to me that other people weren't doing that mm-hmm. at the time. But blogging was so new and fresh at that point. So mm-hmm. I guess no one else really wanted to.
Right.
And I had lots of energy when I was young. Oh, the energy I had. So these were massive write-ups. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look back at them. I'm like, oh, to have such time.
Mm-hmm.
How glorious that must have been.
Yeah. You have children. I have children. And
yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
It's like, why didn't we do more with our time before we had kids? You know, that's something my wife and I talk about sometimes.
I used to write a review of a book a day, like a 10-paragraph review of a book every day. I look at that, I'm like, what the heck? That's weird. That's just weird.
The role of a librarian. Now, to provide some historical context, you did bring up Ann Carroll Moore. I mean, she was credited for how we view libraries today in terms of like welcoming for children. I mean, she was responsible for the children's sections of libraries. And back then, children weren't even allowed in libraries until they were of a certain age. And Ann Carroll Moore kind of changed the game and welcomed children, and not just, she welcomed all kinds of children from all sorts of perspectives and experiences and upbringings. And so I'm framing this up in a way like she did quite a bit for children and for children's books. I'm saying that because she was also a little bit of a
kook, a little kooky.
She had a stamp that said not recommended for purchase by expert.
This has possibly been incorrectly attributed to her, successor. Had the stamp. I discovered this in my research. It was actually Frances Clark Sayers who had the stamp, but no one remembers that anymore. So they all credit it to her. Okay. Yeah.
Now,
I wish I had that stamp. My gosh.
Recently, the New York Public Library released the most checked out books of all time. Top 10, I think. Goodnight Moon was not one of them. Surprise, surprise. And that was because Ann Carroll Moore did not like the book, among other classics. And we'll talk about those in a sec. But she didn't like Goodnight Moon. She thought, and please correct me if I'm wrong, her sort of philosophy in terms of what children's books should be was that like fuzzy bunny morality, you know, like there once was a bunny named Sickly and he sure learned his lesson quite quickly. Like that's the kind of book that she liked. And Margaret Wise Brown was of the sort of Bank Street philosophy, which focused on the here and the now, the let's talk to children on their level. Let's show children that it's okay. There are different kinds of normals and there are different kinds of experiences and it's okay to feel those things. And so she and others were focused more on that and not on the once upon a time stuff. There was a little bit of like a push against what a children's book should or shouldn't be from Aunt Carol Moore's perspective. Mm-hmm. The New York Public Library did not have Goodnight Moon available for decades after it was published. Goodnight Moon almost died on the vine, but through word of mouth and just other ways, it went from like 6,000 a year purchase to 8 to 22 and on and on. And obviously it's what it is now. But anyway, here's my point. Is that the role of a librarian? What is the role of a librarian as far as what they determined a book should or should not be for kids?
Right. So we're talking selection then. So In Anne Carol Moore's case, you got to understand, there weren't a lot of children's books being published at that time. And this is a philosophical question to a certain extent when it comes to Goodnight Moon, because Goodnight Moon, let's just admit it, classic, amazing book. It's weird. Mm-hmm. It's weird. Look at the color scheme. That is a weird color scheme. It's Goodnight Nobody, Goodnight Mush. Really strange. Aunt Carol Moore was more of the Peter Rabbit. You know, she loved Beatrix Potter. Those weirdly scientifically like accurate bunnies, like, you know, who get spanked occasionally and weird stuff happens and their fathers get baked into pies. They're not ooey gooey. She wasn't ooey gooey. She just liked a story. There's no story in Goodnight Moon. Mm. Also, she didn't much care for Margaret Wise Brown. That's on record.
Why?
Not her favorite gal. They, again, the Bank Street philosophy of education and of children, of getting down on the child's level, you know. So you got Margaret Wise Brown, you got Ruth Krauss, you know, you got people who are like speaking, who are listening to children, who are trying to make books like from the perspective that a child could understand. This is not Aunt Carol Moore's entire job is saying, look, I'm the expert. I am handing down to you the best literature for children. Mm-hmm. Only the rarest kind of best is good enough for our kids. Here, have this book. And to be like down on their level, that would have been completely against everything that she wanted. So your question is, you know, what is the role of the librarian? Well, at the time, the role was, look, there was a lot of crap children's books out there, not mm-hmm. Goodnight Moon, but there was some bad stuff out there. There's the whole, they hated comics. They hated any series, basically. They wanted good literature.
Right.
They were like, look, adults get good literature. The adults don't think there's any worth in children's books. We are going to show them that children's books. So she helped start the Newbery. She helped start the Caldecott. You know, she's like, look, we're going to celebrate great literature, great books. And the flip side of that is I'm the expert. You're not the expert. I've dedicated my whole freaking life to this. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this book. This book is not good enough. Also, I only have so many dollars to spend. I am New York Public Library. But I can't buy everything.
Right.
So I'm going to have to make decisions. And every librarian has to do this. They have to make decisions. Like, well, this book's coming out. It got so-so reviews. I just don't have the dollars to buy every possible book out there. I have to select. I have to say yes to you and no to you. And then later, if a bunch of people come to me and are like, how come you don't have this book? Then I buy it. Mm-hmm. She probably didn't listen to other people in that way. Hence, Goodnight Moon does not make it into New York Public Library. It wasn't the only thing that didn't make it. The Little House books didn't make it. Wizard of Oz didn't make it. Mm. There were whole swaths of things. I don't think Clifford was in the libraries until I started my job there. So,
really?
You know, yeah, well, you know, it's one person's opinion saying, I don't like this book. I'm not going to buy it. Right. And they don't.
What was her issue with Stuart Little?
Well, first off, remember Stuart Little. I hated this book when I was in third grade because of the ending. My daughter has just in third grade come home to me and she comes to me. She goes, what's up with the ending? I'm like, oh, you are my child. Thank you. Stuart Little, the whole issue, you know, she was just so into the idea of E.B. White being a children's author. And every time he wrote a book, she got disappointed with him. So, you know, he writes Stuart Little, and you have a mouse, a woman, a human woman giving birth to a mouse, which right there, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking this, you know, Anne Carroll Moore was, you know, old school Victorian lady, you know, humans giving birth to mice. That's weird. I don't care who you are. That's mm-hmm. just bizarre. Mm-hmm. So she's got that issue. And then she just didn't like book. You know, she's allowed not to like a book. Is she allowed to not put it in the library? That's a question. But it was in the library pretty soon after its publication. That didn't stay out for years. She didn't like Charlotte's Web, for crying out loud.
Why?
She thought it mixed fantasy elements with realism in a way that she found unnerving. She's like, you know, stick in your lane. If you're going to do a realistic book, do a realistic book. If you're going to do a fantasy, do a fantasy. This weird mix of the two, it didn't work for her. Again, philosophical level. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. on that point, she and I disagree.
Right. You mentioned Wizard of Oz. You mentioned
That wasn't in any library. Right. Yeah. There were series.
Yeah.
Series books were all lumped together. If you're a series, you're out. Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys, nope. None of that in our libraries. Thank you very much. So yeah, you tell someone today, like, oh, the Little House books weren't in the library. It's like, oh, that's very forward thinking of them. Like, no, not for that reason.
Right. Well, that's what,
that's not why.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my next point. And that is, I mean, you mentioned, and also the Wizard of Oz. So like, you know, L. Frank Baum, which I think his first name is Lyman, if I'm not mistaken, but there have been current criticisms in Little House. I mean, there's, you know, I don't have to say what they are. Everyone sort of sees them and knows them and has read about them. And same with Oz. At what point with books like them and other books that do receive either due or undue criticism, do you decide as librarian that, you know, separating art from artist is not possible with this book? Or do you separate the art from the artist?
Well, that's the question now, isn't it? So yeah, this is the biggest issue. Man, if I were teaching in a grad school up and coming people about collection development, this would be the hot button issue and question right now. Mm-hmm. And my general feeling is, look, you have the Little House books in your library. You do. But do you promote them? I don't think so. If someone comes asking them for you, you give it to them. But then you also say, by the way, if you want something from a more authentic native perspective that's very similar and really super good, try Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich. You know, you have to, you gotta, you know, you bring, because people love Little House. You know, they love it because of the stupid TV show, but they still love it. Right. And some of them actually love the books too. Now, I just opened a new branch and we had to buy children's books for it. And we wanted to do a mix of classic and contemporary. Did I buy that for that new branch? I didn't. They can get it at the main branch if they want to. It's in our consortium. They can get it. We don't deny the access, but I'm not promoting it, right? Okay. So it's that balance. It's like, look, our job is to provide. The way I always, whenever I buy anything that is like offensive or, you know, that I would find personally offensive for the library, mm-hmm. my justification is, look, I'm buying this so you don't have to. My purchase means that 20 people out there curious about this book don't have to buy it themselves. I am providing the information and they are coming to me because I'm a library, right? It's like, that's my job.
Yeah.
So what's the line? If you go into a library and there isn't something in it that offends you, we're not doing our job. That's generally true.
Another book or another author who has received criticism, especially of late over the past 5-10 years, is Dr. Seuss.
Mm-hmm.
Justifiably. A lot of the stuff that he did early on was incredibly racist. Even some of the early books post-World War II were pretty damn racist. People renamed the Laurel Ingalls Wilder Award for that very reason, for the reason mm-hmm. of having that book be hurtful, right? Mm-hmm. For a marginalized group. Why aren't we renaming the Geisel Award? When will it be renamed?
So here's the question. That's a good question. I think Dewey Decimal, there's a Dewey Decimal or a Dewey Award too, John, you know, named after that sexist dude who made the duodecimal system. Yeah, that got renamed too. So first of all, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award was weird right from the start. How many words can you name where the award is named after the first person who got it? That's just that's just lazy award naming right there.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite cereal used to be Product 19. I used to call it the cereal that they just gave up on naming, right? So that right there, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, it just made no sense. Also, you know, she's the kind of author who writes things like, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Now, Seuss never wrote that in his children's books. Are they super racist? Oh, Lord, yes. Mostly in the picture book area. Anyone who has picked up Caldecott honor-winning book, If I Ran the Zoo. Oh, If I Ran the Zoo, you're the most surprised it's racist book of all time. There are three instances of extreme racism in that book. Mm-hmm. And it's awful. His easy books, well, you've got the whole debate about The Cat in the Hat. In fact, Phil Nell wrote that wonderful book, Was the Cat in the Hat Black? Where he talks about the entire history that surrounds that book. But the Geisel Award, will it be renamed? I don't know that it will, honestly, because he never wrote anything quite as overtly racist in his easy books. The Cat in the Hat is the most racist thing in his easy books. Mm-hmm. It's his picture books. To think I saw it on Mulberry Street. You know, he's got stuff in there.
Yeah.
So I would not be surprised if it's never renamed. It's also not called the Dr. Seuss Award. No. It's called the Geisel Award.
Right.
So right there, that distinguishes something. I am not feeling a huge push on the part of people to rename that one.
I'm frankly surprised by that, though. I mean, the reasoning for the renaming of the Laura Ingalls, it's always a tongue twister for me, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, that reasoning applies inconsistently then.
It's true. And, let's consider this. How many people of color have won the Geisel Award? How many people of color are writing easy books? Not a lot are coming out right now.
Right.
And I wonder if that changes, if then, because that's what happened to a certain extent. Jackie Woodson was going to be given the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award and was like, well, thank you, but I don't want to accept an award with a name like that.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, yeah, she makes a good point. Let's just change it. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, are we going to need another Jackie Woodson before the guys get the award? I do not know. Right. Prognostication is not my fine point, as any Caldecott Newbery prediction post I write will quickly show. So.
You know, I wanted to talk about the Caldecott and the decision-making process, but again, we're tight on time. And so I'm just going to skip the Caldecott and move on to transitioning from Dr. Seuss to the problematic, dare I say, creator to Dr. Seuss or Geisel the editor. Now, Geisel the editor hired Stan and Jan Berenstain.
Yes, Berenstain.
And to do a book, it was I think their first book was The Big Honey Hunt, and published in 1962. The reason I bring up Berenstain is because there are people in this world who legitimately believe that we live in an alternate timeline.
Yeah.
This is a weird transition, but whatever.
Oh, it's true, though.
So we live in an alternate timeline because everyone, seemingly everyone, believed that it was Berenstain. Dean, with a S-T-E-I-N, when in fact it was always S-T-A-I-N, their name. It was always has been. And so there's a legitimate physicist who's written about this, who has said that it's essentially a false memory brought upon by the fact that we now live in a parallel universe, parallel timeline. And there's an actual name for this. It's called the Mandela Effect.
I love this theory. It is one of my favorite children's literature-based theories of all time. And I'm not innocent of it. I remember it as Berenstain.
Me too.
It was a big shocker for me in library school, or maybe it was when I was first a librarian. You type in Berenstain, nobody comes up. And then you look at the books and you're like, Berenstain? All right. And I guess my memory's wrong. But why is everyone's memory wrong? It's weird.
It is very weird.
Oh, we all have the same false memory.
So we do live it. So we do live in an alternate timeline.
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe that. If this is the one clue, so be it.
Oh my gosh. I just said that I wasn't going to talk about the Caldecott, but I do have a quick question. Back in 96, Peggy Rathman won the Caldecott, and it was for Officer Buckle and Gloria. I don't know. Maybe my perception's wrong here, but like once you win the Caldecott, you kind of do more books and things get slightly easier, maybe, for you. But she didn't do much after that. She's done maybe three.
Yeah,
four
she
books?
Did 10 Minutes to Bedtime, Officer Buckle, Goodnight Gorilla, and The Day the Babies Crawled Away, which was her last one.
Right, which was published 10 years ago?
That was about 2000 and I want to say 2003 or 2004. Yeah, right in there.
There's something up here, and I don't know quite what it is. I've done research on her. I've actually worked with her once when I did
really?
A Beatrix Potter celebration, our 150th birthday, and celebration of Beatrix Potter, it was called. And I hired 30 plus illustrators, popular illustrators of that time, 2016 or so, to do reimaginings of her stories. And Peggy Rathman was one of them. And so working with her was, I'm on the phone and she's like, Giuseppe, so what do you think about this idea? What do you think about this? And she was really kind of like uncertain with her choices. Meanwhile, I'm like cupping the phone with my hand going like, holy shit, I'm talking to Peggy Rathman.
Right.
Yeah, sure, Peggy. No, that's great. So I've worked with her. She's the sweetest, nicest person ever. Side note, her husband's name is John Wick, which is... So don't mess with them.
Watch out for her dog.
Right, don't mess with them. Exactly. Don't take their dog away from them. Here's my question, though. Was there any uproar in terms of like her winning that award? I've read kind of that there was. Do you have any insight?
Vaguely.
On that?
My sense was there vaguely was. I remember this was before my time when she won, but New York Public Library used to take out a table at every banquet, and we still had, when I worked there, the Officer Buckle hats, which were police hats with dog ears that they all wore to the banquet because that's what they did. They loved it. But that was not a universal love. She was up against some pretty high contenders. I don't remember who the honors were that year, but there was a bit of an uproar. It was an unusual win, a funny book. So right there, funny doesn't tend to win, and not, you're not looking at your Eric Carle hand painted, cut paper. You're not looking at like lush landscape, watercolors, it was cartoony. Funny and held together, but cartoony. And yes, there probably was a bit of a backlash against it. Makes sense. Now, she is considered the Gary Larson of children's literature. She just decided, you know what? I would rather take care of sheep than write any more children's books. Mm-hmm. And so she did. And I got nothing but respect for that. I'm like, you know what? Is that what you want to do? Go out on a freaking high note. Her last book was The Day the Babies Crawled Away. That book's amazing. Yes. I just did that book with Aaron Reynolds on my podcast, Fuse 8 and Kate, where we examine it page by page. That is the most, it just holds up so well. It's so innovative.
Yeah.
So crazy good. And if she's just like, drop the mic, baby. I did an amazing book. I'm going to Wyoming or wherever it was.
California.
Taking care of sheep.
Yep.
I'm like, you go, girl, if that's what she wants to. Now, of course, everyone, including myself, just hopes someday she comes back.
Yeah.
Just 20 years, she's gone, and then poof, she's back. Oh, my gosh, it would be like the biggest thing of all time.
It would be.
But maybe not. Maybe she's happy with her sheep. I don't know. Could be.
Yeah.
But you got to respect it, though.
Yeah.
You got to respect it.
Every few days or so, I post art history. I post a little bit of art history, mostly children's book art history on Instagram, and it takes me a long time to get the articles and read them, and I'm always looking for that little bit of like, oh my God, can you believe that happened? Oh, I'm definitely writing that in. I wish I had known about your book, Wild Things, a couple of years ago, because it's all in there. All of it is in there. The stories behind the stories. So you wrote it with Julie Danielson and Peter Cerruta. In the book, you kind of like pull the fuzzy curtain away from who these creators actually are. In fact, I heard that during a reading of maybe they were education students, education majors, or maybe they were librarian students. One student started crying and left the room and said to Julie that, you know, Julie said, well, you know, what happened? What did we do? And she said, you ruined it. What ruined? Ruined everything.
Yeah. Ruined her childhood.
You ruined her childhood.
Her entire childhood just gone.
Because of wild things.
Yep.
Bummer when
that happens.
Yeah. What's one story in Wild Things that you're just like, this story is just a wonderful story.
Oh man. That's actually in the book. Okay. Let me see here. Cause there's a bunch of stories that couldn't make it in the book. Cause we couldn't confirm them with facts, or people were still alive that would have objected to our putting it in the book. There's a bunch of those, man. And some of them are like legend amongst publishing people. Like, oh, you know the dead cat story, right? Oh yeah, I know the dead cat story. Mm-hmm. Dead cat story is the best. In the book, let's see. Well, I think the one I always fall back on is what happened to the ducklings from Make Way for Ducklings. That story starts out so well. You know, Robert McCloskey, he's this young doofus, buys a bunch of baby ducks, picks them up, puts them in his apartment in the West Village.
Uh-huh.
They go too fast. It's hard to draw them, so he gives them red wine. Yep. That slows them right down. Mm-hmm. The mallard loved it, would chase all the others away so he could get all the red wine. He's stuck with a bunch of drunk ducks. He tries to sell them to butchers who are having none of it. They're like, we don't know where these ducks are from. Whatever. You would think he would have just let them go in the park or something, but no. He takes them to a farm.
Okay.
And they're at a farm, and that is where I stop telling the story for my children.
Yep.
But we are adults, and the sad fact is that they all got eaten by a fox after that. So that's when you pull out the picture book. Fox went out on a chilly night, and you're like, this is what happened to the Make Way for Duckling Ducks.
Oh, that's great.
And you tell that to somebody like, no, you just ruined the book for me. I'm like, well, see if you can find Richard Nixon on the swan boat, because that's fun too. It's not actually Richard Nixon, but boy, does it look like him.
Yeah. Wanda Gogg is another one who I've read that she even said she either wrote it in a diary, or she might have said it out loud and someone just recorded it and remembered it in some fashion. Something to the effect that she was a little worried that the publishing scene would learn about her, let's call it, loving ways.
Sexy sexiness.
With the dudes and the ladies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wanda.
She was.
Yeah, read her diary sometime, because they are published. And they are. Those read like, wow.
Yeah.
They're little taxicab confessions there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she created millions of cats. A book about cats, billions and millions of cats who, you know, eat each other.
Eat each other up. If you ever want to have fun, find the 90-second Newbery version of that where they do it in Minecraft. That's my favorite version.
Yeah. With that, I asked Leonard Marcus the same question. Do you think that would get published today?
Yes, but not looking the way it does. There's no color in that book. You can't get away with a black and white book unless you're...
It's too bad about that.
It's a bummer.
It is.
But I think the text, I think you could publish the text, but I don't think you could publish the art.
There wouldn't be some like online criticism from the cat.
Oh, there probably would be, but I just read a book the other day where it's the new Arthur Yorinks book. It ends up with the two main protagonists eaten by a spider at the end. You know, it happens.
Okay.
Millions of Cats is tame compared to that one. So, yeah.
One of the stories I really love about one of my favorite creators, Ludwig Bemelmans, goes like this. He's living in Germany. His dad had left. I don't know if his dad passed or left when he was very young. So they're in Germany, and he is a young man, apprentices with his uncle at his uncle's hotel. There's this head waiter there who was, I guess, was his boss, who whipped him and beat him and was just all around an abusive ass to Bemelmans. And Bemelmans one day warns him and says, if you hit me again, I'm going to shoot you. And obviously the head waiter was like, yeah, whatever. So he hits him again, and Bemelmans shoots the guy in the stomach. As punishment, he had a choice: attend reform school or emigrate to America. And he chose America. He then later met Mae Massey, the Viking editor, and the rest is history.
So that was a story that we wanted to put in Wild Things, but here was the problem. The only evidence we have that this story is true is from his own diaries, and the guy was not entirely reliable when it came to this story. He told several different versions of it in many different ways. We can find no evidence that he actually shot a man. But I love the idea. Like, I shot a man just to watch him die. And then I made Madeline. It's like, okay, you go do it.
Yep.
But yeah, I desperately wanted to put that because I wrote the sex and death chapter of my book and couldn't put it in. Couldn't get corroboration on that story. Oh, how I wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah.
The weirdest one is, of course, about... am I going to get his name wrong? George Selden. That was his name, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Cricket in Times Square.
Yep.
Which these days, fun fact, super racist. But anyway, George Selden writes Cricket in Times Square. He also had a thing for couples. And he would go to couples' homes, have a threesome, and then sign a copy of his book to the children of the home, who were presumably sleeping upstairs, unaware of everything,
God.
On his way out the door, because... that's a calling card, my friend.
Oh,
nobody can top that. That's quite something. Yes.
Wow. We have no time left. I have so many more things to ask you, but oh well. Let's remember that there's somebody listening in on this conversation, and I just would like to leave them with a little bit of last word of advice from you. So what would it be from you?
Well, I actually quoted this line a little earlier, and it's from presumably Walter de la Mare. Though I've never been able to figure out where he said it. And it's this line, and it's this old-fashioned line. You know, it's only the rarest kind of best is good enough for the young. But I honestly believe that to be true. We have so many books for kids coming out right now, and just getting through them and finding the best ones, there's a great joy to that. And when you find a really good one, you cannot help but think that right now we are in a new golden age of children's literature.
To learn more about Betsy, visit BetsyBird.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationDEPT. In return, you'll receive a gift, a discount code, and access to short episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.